BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the BDNG podcast. I'm Molly. I'm one of the education nurses. And with me today, I've got Pritesh Mistry, who works for the King's Fund, who has a special interest in technology and AI. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about that more in depth. So Pritesh, could you just maybe introduce who you are, what you do, and maybe a little bit about what interests you in technology or AI in general?
Hi, Molly. Thanks for the opportunity to come on the podcast. So I'm Pritesh Mistry. As you mentioned, I'm a policy fellow at an organization called the King's Fund. We're a health and care think tank. So my work basically means that I research what's happening in the healthcare system in terms of the technology, what technology is being used, what technology is trying to be used, what are the impacts of the technology. And we do that research at both the front line, so at the point of care delivery, as well as at the government and a national level, to try and understand, okay, what's actually happening at that point of care delivery, and what's the plans at that national level, and how well are those two actually coming together. And so our research aims to build an evidence base on the use of technology, the implications around that across health and social care. And we publish that as our reports or some of our thinking in our blogs. And we do that in order to kind of share what's working, what's not working, to make sure that that information is more accessible to people so people can understand some of the challenges they may face, some of the ways of overcoming those challenges, what some of the plans might be in the future, and where things are kind of heading in general around technology development. And then as we also use that information to speak with government, national bodies, senior leaders to kind of help some of the plans that they might be making. So that's kind of my job. My background is engineering, and I spent about 10 years in hospitals and general practice supporting research and research to clinical utilization, and then creating companies from that work, or licensing IP to support that technology development and research development to be actually use in validated products. So I've been in this space for quite a while, I suppose, and it does continue to interest me. So I suppose your question was around technology and AI in specifically what there is that interests me. So I suppose on reflection, I'd say technology in general is, I suppose, the engine of change in the world today. And I think it's amazing how powerful these tools can be, but also how patchy these capabilities can be. And I think AI really kind of exemplifies that. You hear such a spectrum of opinions and experience on something like AI, and how it can't even count the number of R's in the word strawberry. I think that's been fixed now, but then how it can completely code a new app as well. So it's real spectrum of capabilities and patchiness as well. But what I suppose has continued to really enthuse me is the change that this technology and the ramifications that technology can have, and its ripples across what we do, how people relate, and even how people can view themselves. So they can change our jobs, they can make us question what we are doing and why we're doing it. They allow us to communicate across different geographies. So online consultations, for example, can be from one part of the country to another. They can allow us to communicate asynchronously as well, so you don't have to be talking to someone in a live stream. And so that power is substantial in what change it can allow us to happen. And then I suppose with the recent developments with AI, it's making us question, you know, what's the role of a person in providing care, and how is that integral to the feeling of being cared, of receiving care? And it's questions that we've not had to ask before. So I suppose there's something about technology and AI throwing everything up in the air and really making us question things. And I suppose just kind of round it off, what particularly interests me right now is what AI in particular means for how things can be different. So we're all familiar with the pressures on the healthcare system, the constraints, the challenges, the problems, So what is it about this technology that is radically different that allows us to do something different to actually move forward and solve some of these problems?
And I think that brings me on to my next question. So a lot of people might be aware of AI and they might use it, but what is it? What is the kind of basic of AI? How does it kind of work? And a lot of people, I think, would call things AI that might actually not necessarily be AI. So could you just maybe briefly explain that a little bit for us?
I'll give it a go, but a bit of an exclaimer, I suppose. I'm not technically orientated in that way, and it's been a while since I've been an engineer. So it'll probably be a high level kind of description of AI. And I hope that that's okay for people listening. So I'd probably start as AI as a concept has been around for decades. So it's not necessarily a new thing. It feels new. It's had a few different kind of leaps and bounds during its history. And I suppose the concept of AI has always been around human decision making in software form, in essence. And so that's continued to change as a concept of what it means, depending on the latest leap in technical capabilities. So it's generally powered by computer chips, the accessibility of data, and the algorithms as well. So it's those combination of three things that enable AI to exist. And the earliest AI is probably back, if you think, back in the 70s, which was more considered to be what would be termed as rule-based AI. So if you're familiar with things like decision trees, like how you might navigate a map, for example. So you get to a junction, you turn left to get to a certain place. So a decision tree would have a yes, no, or a particular set of criteria that allows you to make a certain decision. So that's very deterministic. So as soon as you get to a certain point, you can make a certain decision depending on the information that's already been allocated. And so that was the earliest type, and it was very manually coded into software. And it turns out that that's very difficult to do, very time consuming, and it starts getting very challenging when you start trying to define things in images that you might recognize. So a mole, for example, and when a mole looks cancerous, for example, how do you describe that in words? How would you describe that as a decision making process? It can be quite difficult, as opposed to an experiential learning. And so that led to the next phase of AI, which is more around machine learning or deep learning, where AI algorithms are basically able to take you have an AI algorithm and you give it a group of images and they're clustered or they're labeled, and the AI algorithm is able to self-adjust, in essence, what is referred to as self-learning. So it adjusts its own programming to be able to determine certain things. So if you have a group of images that may be, say, lung images, and some have tumors and some don't, and those with tumors are clearly marked up as so, then the AI would self-adjust to be able to identify those features that have already been marked up in the training images. And so it self-adjusts to do that, and that's known as machine learning or deep learning. And these are what are termed as black box systems. So they're not, as I mentioned, not hard-coded, so no one's sitting there and telling the software what to do. It's self-adjusting, and that has pros and cons. The pros being that you don't have to spend so many programmers' times to be able to do this, but also it then means that you don't really know what's going on in the system. And so there's been examples of where it's learning off the wrong feature within an image. So there's been examples where someone's been trying to create an AI algorithm that's able to discern a skin lesion, for example, and it happens that there might be, say, a ruler next to several of those images, and instead of learning off the feature of the mole or the skin lesion, it'll be learning off the feature of the ruler being in place. And so you don't always know what is learning or to detect until you actually interrogate the functionality of an AI tool. And so that was one of the more recent enablers or developments in AI. And I suppose the most recent, and what we tend to mean when we talk about AI now, is generative AI. So that's the the tools that you might be familiar with, like the ChatGPTs produced by OpenAI and Claude from Anthropic, Gemini from Google. So those are the new software capabilities that have been unlocked through even more data being accessible through the internet, a new capability through algorithms and really powerful GPUs or graphic processing units, so new bits of hardware as well. And those three coming together most recently, I suppose, back in 2022, I think it was when ChatGPT was launched, really kind of enabled something very different and shocked and surprised quite a few people. So that's the generative AI capability. And basically what that's different from what I was talking about in the tree, the deterministic decision tree AIs in the 70s, because these are more probabilistic. So if you've played with these tools, you'll put in a prompt and it'll give you something in reply, a paragraph or more of text. And if you put in the same prompt, it will give you something different because it's probabilistic. So it won't give you the same thing twice. And so you take a prompt, so sort of a sequence of words in response, it will give you something in as an output. And that might be a sequence of words, it might be an image if it's an image generation tool. And basically what's happened is they've put a lot of data into an algorithm, and that algorithm has created linkages between different words and how frequent they are. And this has then been tuned with human feedback, and they've done something called goal orientated learning as well. So they try to give it tests and be able to orientate how well it is able to perform against some of these questions. And that has created the tools that we have today. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a run through the AI developments and where we are at today.
I think it kind of links back to how you're saying it's almost a little bit like the Industrial Revolution of it started out with this tiny, rocket steam engine, and then it's built up to something like the car, which is now a hybrid. So as we go across years and learn more, it will continue to change. You mentioned about, for example, the AI algorithms used in diagnosing of moles. Do you have any other examples of how AI might be currently used in the NHS at all?
Yeah. There's lots of examples. As I'm sure everyone's aware, the NHS is very good at doing pilots, and quite a few of those pilots now include AI. And so you can go to our website, the King's Fund website, and we've got a publication showing some of the case studies of how AI is being developed and used in the NHS, and some of it's quite highly developed. So I suppose some of the examples, the way we kind of categorized it is improving quality, improving or enabling education and training, supporting workforce safety improvements and productivity. So just kind of quickly running through those. Improving quality of care with things like segmentation of images. So as we mentioned with dermatology, being able to identify moles, being able to segment heart valves in ultrasound images. So that kind of looking at an image, being able to identify a feature and circle it and be able to do measurements on it. So being able to do that for staff, so staff can then check it and take it through to the next stage. And improve quality of care. We've also come across AI being used to search unstructured text. So electronic patient records, a lot of unstructured information, not coded information, but you can search through that with AI tools and find patients who have unresponsive treatments. So you can improve their quality of care by finding patients who are not having the best optimized treatment and be able to provide them with alternatives. And also these tools are being used to improve quality of care by creating surgery reports based on video footage of surgical interventions. For education and training, a lot of people are starting to use this kind of technology to put in their coursework, put in their marking comparisons and ask for suggestions on how to improve it. You can put in papers and things into things like Notebook LLM, and that will give you a podcast and a discussion around some of these papers. So it's a different way of consuming knowledge and information and latest findings. The tools are also being used to coach people in situ during endoscopies, for example. And so we're seeing AI supporting improvements in care, improvements in skills in situ during interventions as well. Supporting workforce, we've got AI scribes, which some of the listeners may have come across already. So that's the kind of AI technology that records a conversation, transcribes that into text, and then summarizes it into a template. And if you've got good procurement happening, then hopefully that will link into your EPR. So at a click of a button, once it's been checked, it can go straight into the electronic records instead of copying, pasting, and doing all these other things. We've also got AI that supports finding internal policies that will help healthcare assistants and receptionists and people within the healthcare system to ensure that they've got the right information to hand when answering questions, but also drafting letters and making that easier for staff as well. On safety, we've got examples of AI being used to optimize anesthetics. So I'm sure, again, people are very familiar with very complex patients coming through on multiple medications. So how do we make sure that they're going to have the right anesthetic? And being able to use AI to kind of filter through that and make sure we've got the right anesthetics for the right patients is becoming quite a powerful tool. And then lastly, around productivity, there's things like going back to the transcription of AI scribes, very similar for MDT meetings, recording, transcribing, providing meeting notes. A really good example of Frimley using an AI tool to call patients post cataract surgery, and that saves a lot of nurse time as well. So yeah, loads of examples, but very small scale, I would say, right now. So pilot stage, we need more evidence. We need to understand how this affects patients, staff, what some of the safety requirements are, and to put it in place, and then it then needs to be shared and spread from there. Their onwards.
And who decides, you know, to put these pilots in place? Is it the government that says, hey, we're going to need a pilot done? Is it the trust themselves? How is that decision made?
So it's a little bit of everyone, really. It depends on which particular example, which particular technology. So there is definitely some national level based priorities in the system. So we are currently with the NHS app, for example, there's a AI triage trial that's going on, and that's absolutely at a national level. The 10-year plan has lots around AI and ambient voice technology in particular. So some of the pilots around ambient voice technologies are supported through that national initiative. Some of them are supported through the suppliers themselves wanting to help to build an evidence base and show how safe those tools are, or what effectiveness these tools have. There's recently been publication of a national cancer strategy, and that's got a lot of AI within it for screening applications, for example. But then at a local level, what we're finding is some trusts, some GP practices, general hospitals as well are trying different tools depending on what problems they are trying to solve. So there's local use of scribes and testing, there's GPs deploying AI receptionists, hospitals putting AI into their websites to answer more of the questions for patients and the public. So it's a little bit of national, it's a little bit of local as well.
Mm-hmm. And let's say when somebody decides to implement this AI, whatever it is, what would you say might be the difficulties for the staff using that AI or in implementing it?
Great question. So I think largely it depends on the technology and the application, to be absolutely honest with you. I think it almost certainly means changing what staff need to do to complete a task. It's some of the difficulties can be around how reassured people are that it's a safe tool to use, how confident people may feel about how to use the tool. So there will be changes around how people work, what skills they need to do to work. The AI scribes, for example, might change consulting practice. They might change what you verbalize. So what we're hearing is a lot of clinicians are now moving to verbalizing a lot of the measurements they might be taking. So a patient being weighed, for example, the patient could see how much they weigh, but they now verbalize that as well. So the AVT, the ambient voice technology, or the AI scribe will pick that up. So minor changes to consulting practice. But then also changes in the practice itself and the waiting area to make sure that patients are aware that these technologies will be used, and that the consenting process is changing as well. So that's kind of surrounding the patient experience. But then the clinician again needs to intentionally check for errors and make sure the details are correct, and they add more information where there might be information missing, and all those other things as well. So that's an additional bit of work that wouldn't have been there before. And so there is, you know, even something as what might seem minor as an AI scribe that just records and summarizes can still mean that people need to change the way they work and the skills that they have, and how we engage with patients to make sure they're informed. So other AI tools will have much more dramatic changes that might require completely different skills to adapt to the role.
And talking about kind of skills and changes in, you know, the way that we might work, how do, you know, we as nurses kind of learn more and upskill ourselves for this kind of future of where AI might be more implemented in our daily work? I know, speaking for myself, you know, I feel relatively computer savvy, but compared to some of my colleagues, I feel like I don't know anything about computers. So, you know, what is kind of, how do we get around that, really?
Yeah, good question. So I think, you know, access to education, training and skill development in AI is absolutely essential. Advocating to leaders to be able to have access to that. Advocating to the group as well. So as you mentioned, you've got colleagues who are much more digitally confident and have more expertise in this space. So creating peer support networks, how do you create opportunities to shadow, network, mentor, support each other as a peer group, not just around AI, but change management and technology as well. Taking any opportunities to have training in clinical safety, I think, will be more and more important in the future. I think we definitely need more people to be involved who are going to be users of the technology. So whether that's operational staff or clinical staff, we need champions and leaders who can shape the tools and how they're used, who can understand the limitations of the technology, I suppose. And by that, I mean, you know, there's going to be limitations of how effective the technology is. There's going to be challenges around bias, which we already see, and that applies to certain demographics, especially when it comes to things like skin lesions, moles, skin cancers, all those other things as well. And so being able to understand the technology, the limits of the technology, and being confident in knowing what support and considerations are needed is going to be more and more important as this technology gets rolled out and continues to develop. So I think it's about supporting each other. It's about networks. It's about accessing education, training and skills development, ensuring that that is coming to your profession through your membership bodies, through your groups that you've got, and with each other. But it's also playing around with the tools. So, you know, take an hour or so and just play around with the tools. I often use some of the deep research tools, and they will give you a nice report, and they might make stuff up. So you need to think about how you validate where the references are coming from, but you can ask it to give you a short report on the use of AI in healthcare for whatever application you want. And you can ask it to only choose evidence-based sources and journals and point it to particular journals and restrict it to only those areas. And that will give you more reliable information. You can ask your friends what they're reading. And like I say, you can put these into Notebook LLM is a particularly good one if you like listening to podcasts, and will create a bespoke podcast based on what you put into it, and you can learn in different ways as well.
And I think you talked a little bit about in the future, you know, we're going to have to learn more about this clinical safety. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, there are concerns, particularly those of us who are involved with working with patients, but also on the patient side, over, well, how does this big, ginormous data that I have, how is that going to be kept safe when it's gone through all these algorithms, or when it's gone through this program? What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. So data governance, keeping data safe, keeping personal information safe is really important. There are requirements on how health data is treated and used. So that comes under GDPR and data protection legislation. So as soon as it's health data, it should be treated differently from any other data. But that means that those purchasing, so the technology, those testing and using the technology, need to ensure that it complies to GDPR and data protection legislation before they start using it, in essence. And so that's making sure that you've got the right links to the right people who are IG experts in your organization, to make sure you've got processes to be able to quickly validate and just do a quick sense check, asking the company for what certifications and ISO standards and things like that that they might have in place to make sure that they are complying to these things, so you are confident to be able to start testing these tools. And so you know when and when not to input patient identifiable data into AI systems. So it's making sure that you've got the right colleagues and the right people around you to make sure that those checks are carried out. You might need to have a governance board in place, and leadership should be kind of enabling that. But I suppose the bottom line is, if you're not sure, don't put patient identifiable information into any AI model. There have been some examples where people have put personal information into public models, and that's definitely not advisable.
And in terms of kind of the future of AI, and you've linked before to the 10-year plan for the NHS, what do you think AI might look like in 10 years' time for our healthcare system? What do you envisage?
So I think there's a few different parts to this, and in my head that's bouncing around, and I'm not quite sure where I'm settling, to be honest. So I think AI is going to be a massive part of the analog to digital shift. The 10-year plan calls out AI several times. And there's going to be AI development at a national level on things like the NHS app, like we already mentioned, and there's plans to be able to have AI companions as part of the app. So that's going to answer people's questions. It's going to give them guidance and support. And I think in probably 10 years time, if not sooner, AI and software are going to be largely synonymous. So we're not really going to have a difference. You're not really going to have software that hasn't got some form of AI in part of it. I'd be very surprised if that wasn't the case. We're going to see AI for imaging and image analysis, AI integrated into scanners, MR scanners, CT scanners, PET scanners, etc. We've got AI for screening in progress as well. I've mentioned AI scribes as well. So we're going to definitely see those kinds of AI technologies. And so I think the opportunity is, or what we can see in the plan, I suppose, is AI is going to help to do things faster and reduce the admin workload. Now, what we're not quite seeing yet is, how is AI going to allow us to do things that are radically different? And that's part of what we're still trying to explore. And so some of the stuff that Eric Topol's been writing about, some of the stuff that Moorfields and UCL have been working on, and we're working with UCL on a project around how you can maybe use AI differently. And some research in Sheffield as well are exploring this question. And some of the things that are starting to come out is post-stroke, people are at higher risk of having dementia, for example. And what you can start doing is, you can start analyzing how people talk, and you can start doing early diagnosis of risk of dementia. And we are working with UCL to look at how eye images, so imaging the back of your eye, could give you more information on a person's health in general, and risks for other diseases like kidney disease, like heart attacks, like strokes. And so what we could potentially see in the future is different ways of gathering information to really support people to understand what their health is currently like, what's their risk look like in the future? How do we support them to change their risk behaviours? And we could end up with care that is quite different to how we find care today.
And I think, again, that's kind of about this idea of, you know, it's a rapidly changing field. It's almost like Industrial Revolution 2.0. And it's difficult to predict what exactly might happen in 10 years. I think one of the things about AI is that it doesn't replace the human being. It just potentially will help that human being. Maybe, you know, they've got a lot of the admin, as you were saying, or that dictation that they've got to do. It might actually help them a little bit, be a little bit more human with that patient. So we'll see what happens in 10 years time. It might all be different. Our predictions might not come true.
I think just on that, I think you're right. You know, I think we're at risk of conflating what a computer can do and what you can do in a computer to what you can do in a physical environment. And so, yes, you might be able to, you know, do the documentation, analyze images, but you can't operate people. You can't hold people. And, you know, in the physical space, it's much more difficult and different. And so right now, AI is software. Right now, AI is embodied in a computer. In future, it might be embodied more in robotics as well, but it's going to be a long journey to get in there. So what happens on a computer could potentially have massive implications through AI, but care will still need people, and it's still a physical process as well. So I think that there's definitely something around accelerating some things, but other things may very much remain the same.
What do you think people should go away home with at the end of this podcast? What would be your kind of top three take home messages from today's session?
I think firstly, I'd say the technology isn't set. So it's developing, and it's really changing, or it's changing so quickly all the time. And so I think that that's important to remember, because what you might think this technology isn't able to do today, it might be able to do in 6 months' time. So being able to keep that in your mind and revisit prior assumptions is very important. Secondly, I think just building on that technology being set, we need more involvement from staff and patients. We need to make sure we get the best possible benefits from this technology, and that means engaging proactively, because it isn't set, it isn't predetermined. We can shape and shift this technology in a way that works better for everyone. And thirdly, I'd say it's not a silver bullet. A lot of people are thinking AI is going to change everything and transform everything. I think there's potential for it to be part of a solution to the pressures and challenges in the system, but it's not going to be the only solution. It's going to take changes in culture, in leadership, in the way we work, and all sorts of other things as well. But we can do that collaboratively and together.
Thank you for those take-home points. How do people kind of find your work, find more about the King's Fund? Where would they find that information?
I would suggest going to our website. So the King's Fund website, you can find us on socials as well, on LinkedIn. You can look me up and feel free to message me. More than happy to talk to people and find out what's working for you and what's not working for you and how we might be able to help.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. And I hope that you have enjoyed today's session.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.